Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, December 5th, 2017.
This is the Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Monday, we brought you the latest on reports of sexual harassment, sexual assault, and bullying by the former host of this program, John Hockenberry. That news broke in New York Magazine in a story written by author and journalist Suki Kim. Suki, who wrote about her personal experiences with John Hockenberry, also talked to some women who've worked on and around The Takeaway over the last several many years. Here's Suki on our show yesterday.
Look, I think that management did not protect these women. And everybody turned a blind eye because I was looking into this, for a month? You know, these people have been there for a decade.
Well, today we look at what John Hockenberry's behavior meant for the work environment at The Takeaway and our parent station, WNYC. We again invited WNYC president and CEO Laura Walker on this program today, as well as WNYC's chief content officer, Dean Capello, who for a long time oversaw many elements of this show. They both declined to come on our air today. Although Laura Walker did appear today on WNYC's local Brian Lehrer show, we'll have some excerpts from that interview in just a moment. And a reminder, you can read New York Public Radio's full statement about John Hockenberry as well as PRI statement on our website. That's at thetakeaway.org. Ilya Meretz was working on his own investigation of John Hockenberry's behavior and WNYC when Suki Kim's story broke. Ilya is a reporter in the WNYC newsroom. He's in the studio with me now. Ilya, thanks for being here.
Hi, Todd.
Before we get started with this conversation, please let's quickly just reset what we know, what you know about the confirmed allegations about John Hockenberry's behavior here.
Yeah, so there are four confirmed allegations of harassment by John Hockenberry at the show. Going chronologically, the first was a producer in 2011 who said that when she and John were meeting to talk about show business, and they happened to be alone in a room, he kind of leaned over and kissed her unexpectedly. It was also unwelcome. The next allegation comes from another producer who said that John propositioned her to get a hotel room together. Both of those women no longer work at the station, and that those allegations were not reported to executives at the company, as I understand it. Then we have Suki Kim herself, who, through a WNYC employee, filed a complaint this past year, early this year, I should say. And Suki had appeared on the show, and John had basically made himself a nuisance in her life over the course of about a year, constantly wanting to make dates and hang out, and it just was very unseemly and annoying to her. And then lastly, a former producer, Kristen Meinzer, came forward and told her story about being kissed, similar to the first producer I mentioned, being kissed by John against her will, and Kristen also no longer works at the station.
And Ilya, talk about John's behavior inside the studio with a series of co-hosts who he worked with over the years.
Yeah, it's really striking. The first co-host, the founding co-host, Adore Udoji, isn't talking, but I know from people who were there at the time that John seemed to undercut her a lot of the time, that John and Adora clashed a lot of the time. And then we get a much more detailed picture from the second co-host, who was Celeste Headlee. Celeste Headlee joined in 2009, and she stayed until 2012. She said things were cordial for a period of a few months. She really liked John and respected him. But at a certain point, he just started constantly jumping in on her interviews, thinking that he knew better, kind of having to be the loudest voice in the room. He would also kind of rattle her cage before and after the show, and was really prone to a lot of emotional outbursts that made it very hard for her to do her job. She finally escalated that, filed a formal complaint in April of 2012. In July of 2012, she was told that she no longer had a job because The Takeaway was changing format, going to a midday, more of a midday type show. In many markets, not directly competing with Morning Edition, and only 1 hour. So they only needed one host, and they chose to have John be that host. I should also quickly mention Farai Chidea, who was a frequent fill-in host. She is African-American. One time she reported that she met with John, and John said words to the effect of, you don't want to be the diversity hire here, and also you ought to lose weight. And I know that Farai also reported that to station management.
All three of these women, two hosts and one temporary fill-in host, Adora, Celeste, Farai, all African-American women, it should be pointed out, which is part of this story as well. Ilya, Laura Walker was on WNYC's local program, Brian Lehrer, earlier today. She has not come on this show, but we do have some cuts from her. And she didn't talk to you either, as I understand it. Is that correct?
No.
Okay. So what we have then are Laura Walker's comments on another show here at WNYC. Here's what she said.
Every day for the last several weeks, I have asked myself whether we took enough action and whether we should really look at our protocols. I apologize to Farai, to Kristen, to the women who came forward. I have a huge amount of admiration and respect for these women for coming forward at this time. And I apologize that our protocols were not there and our policies were not there.
Ilya, one of the big questions now is what management knew about John's behavior and when, and what they knew when John's contract was not renewed at the end of June earlier this summer. Here's Laura Walker again.
I can't get into the specific information about that. I will say that I knew about some of the behavior. The media reports over the last few days have been deeply disturbing. Some of the behaviors described in the media were known to me and to New York Public Radio. I was made aware of Suki Kim's complaint, which was investigated at the time, and after consulting with our partner, PRI, we took action.
Now, based on your reporting, Ilya, and Laura Walker's statement there, what can you say?
Well, she's added not all that much to the narrative, I have to say. I'm unsatisfied. I'd like to know who actually made the decision, who pulls the trigger. And if it's made by group, then I hope that Laura would tell us who the names of the people are and what their positions are who make that decision. But she has now said and clarified for the record, he was not fired. His contract was allowed to lapse, and it wasn't over harassment. That's not the reason. They were aware of harassment, but he wasn't fired because of harassment.
Well, he wasn't fired at all. So saying that John wasn't fired
right.
for sexual harassment is dependent on the notion that he wasn't fired at all. His contract was not renewed.
Yeah.
What does Laura Walker say about why his contract was not renewed?
As with so many other things, she has said it's company policy to keep personnel matters confidential. She cited company policy more than she cited the law, and she did say that there is now a full review of company policies. I think she understands that that's very unsatisfying, not only to people who work in this building in New York City, but actually to many of our listeners and members and people who support these shows. They want more information. She says there is a review underway now about over those questions.
Ilya, one of the people who's absent from this conversation so far is WNYC's chief content officer, Dean Capello. He helped start the Takeaway, but was also the upper management person directly responsible for this show for many, many years, above a series of executive producers, all males, I should point out. Irva Gunja is our executive producer now. What has Dean said to you?
Nothing. I've been requesting interviews with the executives at this station. But you are correct. There are a lot of important questions to ask Laura. There's a lot of important questions to ask Dean. I should mention Dean launched the show. He was here from 2007 to create the show. The show officially launched in the spring of 2008, and then he acted as executive producer in 2008 and 2009. And even after he took more of a backseat role, he still held sway over budgets and personnel decisions. It's really clear to me from my reporting that Laura and Dean both knew that John could be a bully to his own staff. They also both clearly knew that he had crossed some lines with three different African-American co-hosts. What I don't know is whether they knew anything about any kind of sexual harassment beforehand. I have no indication that they did, but even barring that, there are so many troubling questions about the stuff that they did know that was happening here at the Takeaway.
And one of the questions that remains on the side of this that is John's behavior in the studio with his co-hosts, with these three women of color who came and went in succession, given the relationships were what they were, and you mentioned that John and Adora clashed and that John and Celeste clashed and that John said offensive things to Farai Chidey, and she was a temporary fill-in, but essentially went away from that role. She was not an employee. Is that as these women fell away from their role in the show at each successive point, that it was John Hockenberry who was left here and was left standing when management decided that these people couldn't get along. It was John who remained.
I think people believed this show couldn't work without John. John had very quick wits. John was really good in a live situation. And certainly in the first years of this show, when it was a four-hour program with a lot of patches and repeats that were happening later on, you needed a host who was really nimble, who was up to this job. John evidently convinced executives at this company that he was that person and that the show was not going to work without him, even if there were a lot of other things about his behavior that troubled them, I hope troubled them, and that ought to have been red flags.
We're going to continue to follow this story closely. Ilya Meritz from the WNYC Newsroom, you're going to help us do that, and I appreciate you being here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, as we've continued to cover sexual harassment and assault in the workplace for months, our phone lines have been opening up. The same is true today. And as we examine ourselves and our internal culture here at our show, your voice, as always, is a crucial part of this conversation.
Calling from Deep River, Connecticut, and I was just listening to about the story about John Hockenberry. I don't know what else to say. Where does it end and where does it start? It's really interesting that men and done what they have for years and nobody really has cared, and now they're being taken to task for it. So I don't know, but let due diligence perform its task, I guess, is all I have to say. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kim from Coral Gables, Florida. After listening to today's episode of The Takeaway, I just wanted to thank Todd Zwillick for his honest remorse and understanding of what he could have done better. I believe that this is a very wonderful example of how all white men who may not be receiving the same treatment or might not be aware of how their colleagues are being assaulted, are being abused, etc., how we can all make changes moving forward.
Kim, I appreciate what you have to say. I am trying to be better, and this episode with John has led me to question a lot of things about myself and about how I've operated in the workplace for my whole career, and I hope it's doing that for a lot of other men and a lot of other white men as well. It's a moment for that. Maybe that's one thing to be thankful for here. We're going to continue hearing from you, and we want to keep hearing from you as we always do on the show. In this moment that's been difficult, is difficult, and is a moment of reckoning, not only for the country, but for us here at The Takeaway. And we're bringing you right along with us as that happens. It's important that you stay in touch with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can reach us on Facebook. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. We bring you a conversation now between two women in top jobs at influential news outlets. They are tasked with covering gender and the treatment of women at a critical moment in this country. Koa Beck is the new editor-in-chief of Jezebel, and Jessica Bennett is the gender editor at the New York Times. It's a newly created position at that organization. They both began their roles just in the last month or so, and they each have big goals.
One of my ambitions for Jezebel is that I really want to reframe, quote unquote, women's issues under a spectrum of gender and not just account for women, but I want to account for other marginalized genders as well, particularly non-binary identities. One of the things that I think is so compelling about this landscape now is that in the current dialogue of gender and rights, and particularly under a Trump administration, you don't necessarily have to identify as a woman to have your constitutionally protected rights to an abortion taken away from you in this country. But I do not see enough conversation and dialogue around that. And in my Jezebel tenure, that is a conversation I want to host and have.
And for what it's worth, you know, we were specific in the creation of my role in that it was going to be called gender because we wanted to include those things. Like, this isn't just about feminism and quote-unquote women's issues. That is a piece of it, for sure, but it's also about race and class, and it's about seeing all of the topics we cover already, whether it's sports or business, through this lens of gender. And so I think that's really the goal.
Coa Beck of Jezebel and Jessica Bennett of the New York Times, they're speaking together in our studios last week. Now, it's important to note that they joined us for this conversation before allegations came to light against Takeaway host John Hockenberry, and we're going to be bringing them back for more conversation on that. But first, we hear what they have to say about covering gender right now in America and what to make of the fact that so much of our news and our culture has been defined by men who've been accused of harassment and assault themselves. First, Coa Beck from Jezebel.
I think it absolutely has pulled the wall down in terms of who curates our cultural conversations. The guardians of the topics and the ways in which those conversations are presented to us, the fact that these have been curated by people who have these allegations, says a lot about their views of women and other marginalized genders, their views of what is deemed top of mind, what is the priority, what is the story.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's crazy to look at these men and to think about just how significantly they have shaped our understanding of the world, from politics to media to who gets their stories told to culture to film and television. I mean, it is truly epic in so many ways. And so I've been just thinking about that a lot. You know, what does it mean to have our cultural conversations for years and years and years shaped by men who clearly do not value women and do not respect women? And what does it mean that Harvey Weinstein has been able to, even if we weren't fans of his specifically, literally infiltrate our brains just by cultural consumption, like the number of movies? And in some of these cases, it's hard to quantify. It's like, okay, how do you think about the overall impact that Harvey Weinstein has had on, you know, our children's thinking about how they view the world? And in some cases, it's actually concrete. You know, the Amazon executive who was fired for assaulting and harassing young women on his staff, he canceled the show The Good Girls Revolt. The show The Good Girls Revolt tells the story of the women of Newsweek magazine, which is where I began my career, who sued for gender discrimination in the year 1970, essentially paving the way for female journalists. That is a direct connection to a piece of culture lost, canceled by a man who we now know to harass women.
I think really just game-changing for me as a queer woman who's worked in media for 8 years is that I'm now seeing sexual harassment, assault, sexual violence be the top of the news cycle for more than 4 days. We're so used to the news cycle of one allegation coming out and then a very rich, usually white man goes on paid leave for 6 months. And then Woody Allen has another movie and then everybody goes. And it's heartbreaking and very crushing every time, especially to be the reporter who has sat with these survivors and to ask them to share something like this and knowing the repercussions they're going to take and then to have it be everywhere and then have nobody care after 4 days. So in this particular climate, I do see a certain shift in terms of the conversations going beyond the predators who have often picked them. And I think it reveals a lot also, I think, to public and readers about how these stories get visibility and don't. Look at the people who are choosing them. Look at how they have violated people.
I keep sort of frantically thinking to myself, like, people are going to have fatigue. There's going to be fatigue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of the really remarkable things is that there is not. Like, mm-hmm. this continues to bubble up. This feels like a tsunami. Like, I can't stop using bad weather metaphors for this. It's like tsunami, avalanche, hurricane, whatever it is. It's continuing to happen, and the stories are continuing to be told. And there seems to be no end in sight, and that is depressing on many levels. But I think it also shows that there is such hunger for these stories to come out, and maybe we are reaching some sort of tipping point.
I also, like you, share the overall fright that people will stop caring and that people will just start to glaze over, especially readers. They won't care anymore. I also want to offer them, as an EIC, more than just, here is another template of violence and abuse. one of the things that we have discussed as a staff internally is that these absolutely have to be logged, they have to be registered, but how can we push it beyond the impetus being on survivors to share these accounts? Because there is a responsibility there. They're sharing it. So what are we going to do?
So last week, we launched a newsletter called the Me Too Moment. And, you know, part of my job description was to get a gender-focused newsletter off the ground. And the idea was, you know, we would strategize on that and we would come up with our visual identity and we would launch that in early 2018. And then it was like, oh, psych, we got to do this right now. Yeah. And so I found myself last week typing and retyping and retyping and retyping an intro to this newsletter, which is a temporary newsletter as long as we need it, which maybe won't in fact be temporary. But every time I wrote a new top to it, a new story would break or I would have a new idea about how we should be thinking about this. And so I do think that we're not experiencing reader fatigue. Readers are really thirsty for information about how to continue to think about this, but there is a sense of being overwhelmed. And I find myself overwhelmed. You know, how are we supposed to think about this? There are so many new cases every day. And so what this newsletter aims to do is kind of guide people through that.
I would say that I hope for you being at such a crucial role for the Times that your role as gender editor impacts other roles at the Times, that as gender editor, you see more of your colleagues and perhaps editors and teams underneath you develop a literacy on gender that they clearly need and that they need from someone like you.
Yeah, I've been joking that I will be successful when my job no longer is needed. And so essentially my job is to work myself out of a job because I think you're exactly right. Like this is something that should exist across sections, across desks, across platforms, and we, you know, are committed to doing a better job of that. But yeah, you know, a gender editor shouldn't have to exist. Like a gender editor exists because media was created by and for white men largely. And so we are closing that gap, I hope.
Koa Beck is the new editor-in-chief of Jezebel. Jessica Bennett is the new gender editor at the New York Times, as well as an author of the 2015 book Feminist Fight Club.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
Terry from Boca Raton, I want my party back.
Hey, my name is Blake, Columbia, South Carolina, and I have true faith in the Republican Party because I do believe they stand up for what's right, what's making America great about.
Let the Freedom Caucus go form their own party and give the grand old party a place where they deserve.
My name is Samir Malik from Columbia, South Carolina, and I'm an immigrant from Pakistan. I do believe that I represent the Republican Party because I come from the conservative values and they do represent my take.
Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm from Fort Worth, Texas. My Republican Party has drifted too far right.
Hi, I'm Matt from Minnesota. I believe we just need to get back to what, well, I'm not going to say Reagan, but something around what Reagan would do.
We want to get rid of Pence and Rubio and Cruz and all those folks that believe that it's not about fiscal responsibility.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and those are your voices on the future of the Republican Party, because all this week, we're looking at that future of the GOP. The latest news from the Republican Party, the President of the United States gave his official endorsement on Monday to Roy Moore, the Alabama Senate candidate accused of sexual contact with girls as young as 14. And it is official. Just weeks after cutting Moore off and pulling out of Alabama, the Republican National Committee said last night it's back in, pouring money into Alabama to help Moore win a week from today. So what do young Republicans think of their party led by President Trump? Where do they think it's going as the country changes and Trumpism reaches back to an earlier, whiter time? Alexandra Smith is the executive director of the America Rising PAC and the former chair of the College Republican National Committee. She spends her time thinking about millennials, how they vote, and what they want.
I mean, I genuinely do see that among younger Republicans and among a lot of Republicans that there are a lot of condemnations of certain things that have gone on. There have been strong statements made against things that have been going on. But at the same time, what do you do if you're the party in power and you have the White House and you have both houses of Congress? You know, you try to do something with it. And I think that, you know, especially for younger Republicans on campus who have at times felt marginalized, they felt like their beliefs on campus have been mocked and shunned by the administration and by professors, they feel a renewed sense of purpose to get out there and to try to get something done.
How do they want to see that frustration that you just mentioned with political correctness? It sounds like that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
How do they want to see that reflected in a national party? I mean, what else do they care about? Is it still about abortion, taxes, marriages between one woman and one man? Or is it something different now for young Republicans?
Well, I mean, I think interestingly, not so surprisingly, young Republicans, I think, feel differently than older Republicans on a lot of the issues that you just mentioned. This is the most pro-life generation that we've seen since Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, a vast majority of young Republicans support same-sex marriage. So, you know, I mean, I think that there is a huge generational difference. And I think that they're still trying to reconcile, you know, sort of these core conservative beliefs with the new populist tenor that the president espouses and obviously various other people have adopted. And so they're kind of trying to figure out where they belong.
And how do you think that fits with the question of demographics in America? And I'm talking about pluralism, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing is going to stop the changing demographics of this country. It is becoming browner. It is becoming more diverse. The country is more tolerant of gay rights, for instance, than it was even 15 years ago. Those things are not going to change. And so much of Trumpism is a reaction to that. Make America great again. Take our country back. Make things the way they were. Do young Republicans, Alexandra, agree with that sentiment, or do you think they're coming up conservative but okay with the way the country looks and is going to look?
Thank God we have that diversity. Thank God we have this openness and this tolerance. That is what has made America great. And so, you know, I think younger people very much do recognize that. So, I think that it's unfair to conflate necessarily attitudes about a changing world with attitudes of, concerns about a changing world with attitudes of prejudice necessarily. Certainly among younger Republicans, the openness and the diversity is a great thing.
I appreciate what you have to say about young Republicans. They have different priorities. They don't really latch on to the white ethno-anxiety nationalism that's at the heart of Trumpism, I think. So Donald Trump's not going to be president forever. He's probably going to run again in 2020, let's say. Mm-hmm. Young Republicans, by and large, voting for Donald Trump? Do they want to see a challenge to Donald Trump? What kind of candidate do they want to be able to vote for?
First of all, Donald Trump actually enjoyed more of the millennial vote than did Mitt Romney in 2012 and John McCain in 2008. What we had seen consistently in our polling at the CRNC was that young voters, they were looking for a leader that was unafraid to tackle the big challenges of today. They're looking ahead to these next 3 years to see what gets accomplished. There's a lot that's going on, but I think younger voters, they still have their own economic anxiety about, you know, sort of where they are in their life. For younger millennial voters, younger Republican voters, they're going to be looking to see, you know, changes on that front.
Alexandra, let me put one fact to you right before I let you go, because it was pretty stark. Howard Dean, the former DNC chairman, was on this program last week, and he made sure to spout one statistic, and that's that in the recent governor's race in Virginia, 70% of millennials voted Democrat. What do you think about that?
This has been the alarm bell that I have been ringing for the better part of the last 4 years. That is not a shock to me. President Obama captured 2/3 of the youth vote in 2012. We need to get out there. We need to communicate with younger voters in a way that resonates with them. And whether that's through the channels that they watch and they consume, or it's about the issues in a language that they care about. I mean, we can't be talking as a Republican Party in the same way that we talked about things in 1985.
But Alexandra, can you reach out to those young Republican voters and talk to them in a language they understand in the same week that the President of the United States retweets anti-Muslim videos?
Well, I mean, look, I think that the millennial generation, you know, they're not monolithic. I think that they're able to make distinctions. What 2016 demonstrated to me the most is that this is becoming a decidedly less partisan country. It's kind of like a cafeteria. People are just sort of grabbing what they want and leaving behind what they don't. And it's really just about these politicians on both sides of the aisle putting together enough of a package for these voters to actually take with them and to sell to them.
Alexandra Smith with America Rising PAC and former chair of the College Republican National Committee. Alexandra, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I've come to Utah to take a very historic action to reverse federal overreach and restore the rights of this land to your citizens.
That was President Trump speaking in Salt Lake City, Utah on Monday, and the action he took was historic. In fact, it was the largest rollback of federal land protection in United States history. The president announced that his administration is drastically cutting down the size of two national monuments in Utah, Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante. The president says the move will restore the land back to where it belongs, to the people of Utah. Juliet Alperin is with The Washington Post. She's senior national affairs reporter, and she joins me now. Juliet, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Juliet, there has been kind of a twisted series of controversies around Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante since, I believe, President Obama designated them national monuments. What's behind this decision from President Trump?
Well, actually, Grand Staircase Escalante was designated by President Clinton in 1996. So it's been around for over 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, you make a good point that President Obama just declared Bears Ears almost a year ago. And so what you have is these two very significant monuments in southern Utah that have divided people there. You have many conservatives as well as some ranchers and those who are interested in mining who opposed the protection of these lands that stay federal lands but have heightened protections. And then you have strong constituencies that back their creation and designation. That includes, for example, outdoor recreation companies as well as conservationists and many tribes who see particularly Bears Ears, the more recent monument, as a recognition of a sacred ancestral Pueblo site that's incredibly important both historically and also today in terms of some of the practices that many tribes use to recognize this place that is significant for them.
I mentioned a dramatic scaling back of the protected part of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. How much is it being scaled back? Like on the ground, how much land is now open to mining or other resource extraction?
It's a huge reduction, particularly for Bears Ears. There, the monument is reduced 85% with President Trump's action yesterday. He cut more than 1.1 million acres out of that monument, which had been designated as 1.35 million acres. And the proclamation also shrunk Grand Staircase Escalante significantly. By 46%, he eliminated roughly more than 800,000 acres from that monument.
Juliet, you mentioned the tribes in the area who have sacred lands and lots of history on the land that was protected. Are they saying now that that their place on this land is directly threatened, or just that it hypothetically could be in the future if they wind up in a legal fight with somebody else?
What they're arguing is that essentially the president, by shrinking it so dramatically, is failing to sufficiently protect many of the critical sites that are there. One thing to keep in mind is that this is an area, a very broad area, which has tens of thousands of archaeological sites that have been very well preserved because the atmosphere is so dry there. And so you have places that are incredibly important for worship, rock art that dates back thousands of years. And what they're saying is that these areas are already prone to looting and damage. There had been all-terrain vehicle use that had damaged some of their sites. They had been, you know, what they call pot hunters, people who have gone to these sites and stolen it. And they are saying that this history is actually in jeopardy, and that's why the designation was important. And by shrinking it as much as they have, that it is now at risk.
President Trump drastically scales back two national monuments in Utah, Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, part of a broader program of undoing lands regulations laid down by the Obama administration, by President Trump, and other national lands around the country will be taking a cue from this decision. Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post. Juliet, thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right, that's all for us today. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print-and-marketing. Staples, it's pro time. And Westbridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.